bout of whiskey drinking. Maria Lynch was bright and bubbly. Was she ever any other way? Boyd dropped his smile and donned his serious face. The team were on edge to get started. So was she.
Right,
said Superintendent Corrigan, silencing the room.
Detective Inspector Parker will bring us up to date.
The faces before her were full of expectation. Her team were good. They had confidence in themselves and in her. She had to deliver, and she would. She placed her mug on the desk and, pulling down the cuffs of her long-sleeved T-shirt, a habit she couldn't break, she briefed the waiting detectives on the events of the previous day and night and delegated tasks. When she was finished, chairs scuffed along the floor as a heave of bodies shuffled and stretched. The noise increased from a hum to a loud chatter.
All hands on deck!
Corrigan shouted above the din. Lottie could have sworn she heard Boyd mutter under his breath.
Aye, aye, Captain.
She shoved him out of the room in front of her, grabbing her jacket and took a walk over to the cathedral. She had a witness to interview. Father Joe Burke was waiting for her at the gate. The sky was still moody and dark, and Lottie craved the end of winter. Tumbling snow obscured the cathedral, now a cordoned off crime scene. A few early morning onlookers were braving the weather to pause, bless themselves, and leave flowers. The two Gardaí standing in front of the crime scene tape stamped their feet. They looked frozen. Lottie felt the same. Lottie shook hands with Father Joe through thick gloves.
Come on up to the house for a cup of tea, he said warmly.
That'll be great, said Lottie, glancing at the priest's bright blue ski jacket. He had a fur hat pulled down over his ears.
You look like something out of the KGB, she said, smiling.
He led her round the side of the cathedral to the house. It was warm inside the house. Old iron radiators gurgled airlocks into the silence. Tall, dark mahogany cabinets cast shadows up the walls of the tiled hallway through which Father Burke led Lottie.
Tea or coffee?
He inquired, opening the door to a room with decor similar to the hall.
Tea, please.
She needed to expunge the taste left in her mouth from the office coffee. The priest spoke to a small nun who had appeared behind them. She shuffled off with a sigh to boil a kettle somewhere in the depths of the house.
So, Inspector Parker, what can I do for you?
He asked, sitting into a claw-footed armchair. I want information, Father Burke, said Lottie, removing her jacket and taking a seat opposite him.
Call me Joe. We don't need formality, do we?
Okay,
then please call me Lottie.
She knew she shouldn't allow this familiarity. He was a suspect, second on the scene after Mrs. Gavin, and he'd been in the cathedral at the time of the murder. Except sometimes informality helped people drop their guard. I notice you have CCTV cameras inside and outside the cathedral. I need access to the discs.
Of course, but I don't think they'll be of any use to you. The external cameras haven't worked since the drastic fall in temperatures before Christmas, and the internal ones are trained on the confessionals.
Why so? Asked Lottie, inwardly cursing a potential dead end.
Bishop Connor organized it, so we priests can see who is about to enter, in case we get attacked.
Bit ironic, isn't it? She looked up as the nun reappeared with crockery rattling on a silver tray.
And the webcam wasn't working either. It usually gives a live feed from the altar via the parish website. With the holidays, we couldn't get anyone to come fix it.
Another piece of useless information, Lottie thought. Taking the tray to the table, Father Joe thanked the nun. She disappeared without answer. He poured the tea and Lottie poured the milk. They both sipped from delicate china cups.
I need to ask you a few questions about yesterday, Lottie said,
hurriedly struggling herself into work mode.
Is this a formal interview? Do I need my solicitor present? He asked.
She was taken aback but noticed he was smiling.
I don't think a solicitor is necessary at this stage of the investigation, Father, Joe.
She stumbled over her words. I'm trying to establish a few facts. Go ahead, I'm all yours. Lottie felt her cheeks redden. Was he flirting with her? Surely not. He said,
I did 10 o'clock mass, cleared the altar, locked the chalices and Holy Communion into the tabernacle. The cathedral was empty by then. Normally a few people would stay on to pray, but I think the cold weather won out over religion. The sacristan finished up about 10:45 and he went home. I came over here for cuppa, then went back to the sacristy for about an hour to write up next Sunday's sermon. Mrs. Gavin arrived shortly after that and began her cleaning routine. I just said the Angelus when I heard her scream, so it must have been after 12 noon. The priest paused as if praying. What did you do then? Lottie asked. She made a mental note for someone to interview the sacristan. Possibly another useless exercise, seeing as he'd left before the murder. I rushed out to see what the commotion was about and ran straight into Mrs. Gavin. Poor woman, she was hysterical. She grabbed me by the hand and dragged me down to the front pew. I saw the body, the woman, slumped there. I leaned over and listened for her breath, but I could tell she was dead. I said an act of contrition and blessed her. Then I called the emergency services and brought Mrs. Gavin up to the altar where we sat until the Gardaí arrived. His face was pale against the black of his sweater. Did you touch anything around the victim? In fact, did you touch her? She asked. Of course not. I thought of feeling for her pulse, but I knew by looking at her she was dead. Even so, you'll have to call over to the station to provide a sample for DNA analysis, she added, to rule you in or out of our investigations. I am a suspect, then. He locked his long fingers together in a steeple beneath his chin. Everyone is a suspect until we determine otherwise. Lottie tried but couldn't read anything in his eyes. Did you know Susan Sullivan? She watched for his reaction. Was she the victim? She nodded. His face was serene. No, I don't remember seeing her before. He thought for a moment. There are lots of people who come to the cathedral but don't go to mass. They might drop in to pray or light a candle. Ragmullen Parish has over 15,000 people, you know. Do you do house calls? Not unless someone is sick and requests the priest. I visit the hospitals. I'm also chaplain for the girls' secondary school. We say mass and hear confessions, though not many go to confessions anymore. He shook his head. Baptisms, weddings, funerals, communions, confirmation. Is that a lot of work? Which part? Or all of it? His face opened up with a smile. Lottie was silent. She recalled a priest coming to her house to administer the blessing of the sick for Adam. She'd have remembered if it was Father Joe Burke. Then again, Adam was so ill at that stage, she might not have noticed him. Unlike now. Can I ask what you did for the remainder of yesterday afternoon? I accompanied Mrs. Gavin home and waited until her husband arrived. Then I returned and read in my room for the night. I've never seen such a snowstorm in all my life. So you didn't venture out in it then? No, Inspector, I didn't. Why all the questions? Lottie contemplated what she should say, then decided on honesty. We have another suspicious death on our hands. It could be suicide, but we're not totally sure. I wasn't on duty last night and didn't attend to any emergency. What happened? Should I know who it is? James Brown. He worked with Susan Sullivan. Don't know him. God help his poor family. Father Joe joined his hands and bowed his head. We haven't been able to trace any next of kin as yet. Just like Susan. It's as if they were both plucked from thin air and dropped into Ragmullen. I'll ask around. Someone must be related to them. Thanks. I appreciate that. Lottie sighed, and unable to think of anything else to delay her stay, she stood up. I'll send someone to collect the CCTV discs. Call over to the station today. We'll take a buccal swab and fingerprints. As the investigation progresses, I'll be back to talk to you again. She pulled on her jacket.
I look forward to it, he said, helping slip her arm into the sleeve. This time she saw a definite twinkle in his eye. Handing him her card, she said, in case you remember anything else, that's my mobile number. It was lovely chatting with you. Pity about the circumstances. Thanks for the tea. She pulled her hood up against the swirling snow. When he closed the door, Lottie stood for a moment, blinded by the whiteness after the dull interior, and attempted to wrap her mind around just what had gone on between her and Father Joe Burke. Chapter 13 Boyd took a long drag on his cigarette and exhaled.
We have nothing, he said.
They were walking to the council offices. Lottie wished he would shut up. It was fine knowing they had nothing, but there was no need to remind her. We'll go through their files, she said. There has to be a link in relation to their jobs. Both worked in the planning department, and it is a highly contentious area. They don't appear to have anything else in common, for the moment anyway. Boyd inhaled deeply.
Maybe they were having an affair.
Lottie stopped and stared at him. Then she started walking again, shaking her head.
So what? Both were single as far as we know. But it has to be something dodgy in the planning area, so, he said.
Do!
Lottie mimicked Homer Simpson. Let's see what we can find out. Boyd stubbed his cigarette into the snow and they entered the glass aquarium. The building was unnaturally silent. A few staff walked around with bowed heads as they arrived for work. New Year's Eve jovality now abandoned. Detective Maria Lynch's team conducted individual interviews with all personnel in the second floor room. Lottie looked forward to hearing the outcome. In Sullivan's office, a technician unlocked the computer. Lottie could have done it herself, she thought, after finding the password taped to the underside of the keyboard. Some people never learn. Seated, she scrolled through the electronic folders, stopping the cursor on one marked private. She sensed Boyd at her shoulder. Why don't you start on Brown's computer? She said. She was being a bitch, but he was irritating her. So much for be nice to Boyd day. After an hour of trawling, Lottie looked up to see him standing in the doorway shaking his head. There's nothing unusual here, she said. Her private folders have tax returns and medical insurance. A few items could be of interest, though. For example, the minutes of meetings in relation to a group called Residents Against Ghost Estates. There's about a year's worth. Lottie stretched. Did you find anything on Brown's computer?
Nothing I can understand.
We'll need someone who knows about these things to see if they can spot anything illegal or dubious, Lottie said. I'm going to have a word with the county manager.
Will I tag along?
See about getting these files zipped, or whatever you call it, to the station. Make yourself really useful. She headed out without listening to Boyd's retort. At 45 years old, Jerry Dunn was the second youngest county manager in the country. He managed a revenue budget of millions and a capital budget on a downward curve as the recession hit infrastructural development. During the Celtic Tiger years, he had overseen multi-million euro developments, including a major motorway traversing the country. No comfort to struggling motorists, thought Lottie, as she leafed through the council's annual report outside his office. People couldn't afford the diesel. They couldn't afford the cars. They couldn't afford the taxes, and some couldn't afford to put decent food on their tables. Jerry Dunn continued to earn his 100,000-plus salary annually, and Lottie was sure he was one of those who changed his car every January. His biography made for interesting reading for Lottie, as she waited to be admitted to his office. She thought of her own dwindling bank balance and squirmed. A secretary buzzed her in. His office was twice the size of James Brown's. A chill circulated the room. Snow had settled outside on the window ledge, and mystical images imprinted themselves on the glass where the wind had blown the flakes. A networked laptop, and phone were the only blemishes on the smooth wooden surface of his desk.
"I'll do anything I can to help, Inspector," Dunn said. His striking features were lined with stress and his mouth dipped towards his chin. Short, dark hair had wisps of grey shadowing his ears.
"We're all shocked at these deaths," he said, his eyes appearing to penetrate the depths of her soul. Lottie pitied him, if he could read what was written there. There was a time when these interviews wouldn't have affected her, but that was then. This was now, and her life had changed. "Two esteemed members of my staff in one day, it doesn't bear thinking about. Is there anything work-related that might lead someone to kill Susan? Or indeed James? Though I should state that his death is classified as suicide for the moment." She interrogated his face and found little reaction. They both dealt with planning applications from time to time. "They would have come under political and development-led pressure, Inspector. I can vouch for my staff having the highest ethical standards." His voice was slow and measured. It sounded like a prepared speech.
"Any threats made against them?" she asked.
"Oh, yes. Against other staff, too. During the Celtic Tiger era, developers had millions of euro for land purchase. Acquiring permission to build large housing estates, shopping centres, industrial estates and the like ensured they made a profit. Those late on the scene lost everything. Others early in the game made fortunes."
"How are these threats made?"
"Phone, letter."
He shrugged his shoulders and said,
"I once received a bullet in a miniature coffin."
Lottie remembered the incident.
"And all these threats were reported?"
"Yes, of course."
"You should have records of them."
"I'm sure we do. I'll double check."
"Yes, Inspector, you do that," Dunn said, lips tight, drawing a line under the matter.
Was he reprimanding her?
"Pull yourself together, woman," she warned herself. He was hard to read. At least Corrigan shouted and bellowed and she knew where she stood with him.
"Their current planning files, I need to see them."
"I know you'll tell me that they're confidential."
"Oh, on the contrary," he interrupted. "All planning information is in the public domain. I'll ensure you have access. Will that be all?"
"Where were you around midday yesterday?"
"I returned early in the morning after a few days' holiday in Lanzarote with my wife Hazel. I think ours was the last flight in before the airport shut down due to the weather. Once I was home, I stayed there."
"Will Hazel verify that?"
His smile emphasized straight white teeth. His eyes never moved.
"I'm sure she will."
Jesus, a barracuda in a pinstripe suit. God help the other fish in the aquarium. Lottie went off to find Boyd. The smile slipped down Jerry Dunn's face as soon as the inspector left his office. He looked at the icy river below his office window. He was not a stupid man. He knew she had conducted a character appraisal in the short time she'd been with him. She probably hadn't liked what she found. He didn't care. He didn't like himself much either. Two members of his staff were dead, attracting attention at a time when he wanted to be so far under the radar that he was invisible. The mask of composure, which he could wear so well, dissolved into tiny shards. He sat back at his desk, and trying to hold it all together, he cradled his head with quivering hands, wishing he was back in Lanzarote. Chapter 14. Boyd struggled to keep the car upright, and Lottie braced herself for impact with the ditch. He was an expert driver. Good job.
22,
Lottie said, rubbing cold fingers over her forehead, deepening the furrow.
What?
Asked Boyd.
Trees on the left-hand side of the avenue.
And that means what?
Exactly.
Boyd asked, bringing the car to a halt.
Observing, that's all,
Lottie said. Why was she feeling so stressed? The day was yet young. She got out of the car. A guarded technical van, a squad car, and two other cars were parked on the courtyard in front of James Brown's house. In the daylight, Lottie observed the stone cottage, covered in snow-laden ivy. It dominated the enclosure. A leafless tree, a cairn of rock circling its roots, sprouted from the centre of the frozen cobbled ground. Looks lonely, she thought. To her right, the oak tree, without the body that had swayed from its branches last night, threw ominous shadows in its wake. The state pathologist had been and gone. They pulled on protective clothing, covered their shoes and entered the cottage. From the black and white hexagon-tiled hallway, they walked into the living area. Wooden beams traversed the ceiling. The walls were bare and whitewashed. A round table with four chairs stood in the centre of the floor. A cream fabric couch faced an open hearth fireplace. Red bricks climbed up the chimney breast and extended towards the window. The entire area was stark in its brightness, clutter-free and clean. Scattered around the floor in front of the fireplace were thick white candles at various stages of melt. Lottie smelled only their wax, no vanilla or jasmine. She deduced the candles possibly served a purpose other than exuding a calm scent. The room felt overcrowded with two soccos and a couple of uniforms, along with herself and Boyd. Nothing looked out of place. No sign of a struggle.
"We're finished in here,"
Jim McGlynn told Boyd, ignoring Lottie.
"Asshole," she muttered, interpreting his snub as disrespect.
"Heard that," Boyd whispered.
"Did you find anything we should know about?"
Lottie asked McGlynn.
"We've taken fingerprints and samples for comparisons. That's if you find anything to compare them with. No suicide note."
She nodded and stooped into the kitchen. Small and compact, she opened the fridge. Tubs of organic mush, she noted, lifting and probing, searching through the food. She closed it and inspected the counter. An empty sink, a breakfast bowl, mug and spoon on the drainer. No microwave. The kitchen was clean and tidy. It was obvious James Brown had no teenage children ransacking it. At the bedroom door, Boyd stood, looking in. Lottie joined him. She sucked in a gasp.
"What the hell?"
"My sentiments exactly."
"And I thought Brown was Mr. Stuffy Boots when I spoke to him yesterday."
Lottie explored the small bedroom. It felt oppressive, with a freestanding wooden wardrobe, chest of drawers and a four-poster bed adorned with a black silk quilt. Life-size photographs of naked men blasting out various stages of arousal covered every inch of wall space.
"McLean could have warned us," she said.
Glancing upwards, she motioned Boyd to do likewise. On the ceiling above the bed hung a square mirror, suspended from the rafters with chains.
"You Hefner's only trotting after this guy," Boyd said.
A laptop, open on the bed, was half covered by a black silk sheet. They had his office laptop. This must be a personal one. Lottie tipped the return button with the pen from her notebook. The screen flashed to life. A pornographic site appeared. Obviously Brown was not expecting anyone but himself to return to it. The content was graphic, but featured only adults, not children. She had seen worse during the course of her job.
"Would you look at the balls on that fella?"
Boyd stared at the photographs. Uncomfortable with violating the secrets of a dead man, Lottie slammed the laptop shut and put it under her arm. The technical team could interrogate its history. Boyd began searching the drawers. She went through to a cramped bathroom. A bottle of cologne on the shelf above the sink, a tube of toothpaste and a single toothbrush sat in a glass in the window. A feeling of sympathy for Brown grew within her. She joined Boyd. "Anything?" she asked.
"Plenty," he said.
But there's nothing to point us in the direction of a murder motive. Unless somebody didn't like his sexual persuasion. I still think he topped himself.
It's all too neat. Lottie shook her head. So far, the only common denominator between the victims is their place of work. There must be something else connecting Susan Sullivan and James Brown. Boyd shrugged. They walked outside and removed their protective gear.
Do you want to drive?
He asked, stifling a yawn.
What do you think?
She answered, sitting into the passenger seat.
Put the heater on, I'm freezing.
And I'm not. He started the engine and clipped the fender of one of the patrol cars as he reversed.
What's up with you?
Lottie asked. Something back there excite you? He didn't answer. She closed her eyes and leaned her head against the window. Maybe she should text Chloe to switch on the heating. Maybe not. If they were cold enough, they'd put it on. Getting them to turn it off, that might be the problem. Her phone rang.
Inspector, you know we found Brown's mobile phone in the briefcase?
Kirkby said.
Yes, go on.
We've extracted his recent calls.
Anything unusual or recurring? She hoped they'd had a lead. She needed something fast.
Being analysed as we speak. The last number he called before his untimely demise was Derek Hart's. The second last number is more interesting.
I'm waiting.
It lasted 37 seconds.
Don't play with me, Kirby. Who did he call?
Tom Rickard.
Lottie thought for a second. Rickard Construction. I came across that name on the ghost estate files on Susan Sullivan's computer. I remember all the hullabaloo a few years ago when he got permission to knock down the old bank on the main street and erected his company headquarters monstrosity in its place.
Kirby said, Going by your report, Inspector, James Brown made the call approximately 4 minutes after you concluded your interview with him.
Thanks, Kirby. Lottie hung up.
I presume our next stop is Tom Rickard, said Boyd.
I'm going to tackle him on my own.
Shouldn't I be with you?
I know his sort. Believe me, it's better if I go it alone. I want to pick up that phone printout at the station too. Visibility was increasingly difficult. Boyd struggled to follow the road.
Some way to spend New Year's Eve, Lottie remarked, leaning over to turn up the heat.
She closed her eyes as Boyd swore. Chapter 15.
Mr. Rickard, I hope you can spare a few minutes of your time.
Lottie followed as Rickard brushed past her, striding to the glass lift. You are Tom Rickard, aren't you? She stepped in beside him.
Are you still here?
He asked. She folded her arms without budging an inch.
You need an appointment, he said, pressing his chubby finger on the button to keep the door open.
She flashed her ID badge in his face.
Rickard glanced at it and smirked.
I should have recognised you, Inspector, but you look different from your newspaper photos.
I need to ask you a few questions.
Lottie stepped into his space.
Joke, he said.
I'm very busy, but as you're already here, I'll spare you 2 minutes.
He pushed number 3 on the keypad. The doors eased closed and the lift rose quickly. His office appeared to take up most of the third floor.
Despite herself, Lottie admired the man's taste. The space was modern and sparse, with bright, warm colours mirroring the sleek character before her.
Rickard removed his cashmere coat, hung it on the marble coat rack and seated himself behind the desk, indicating a chair for Lottie to sit. She didn't know anything about designer clothes, but estimated his coat would cost at least a week of her wages, perhaps two. Another world. His grey suit had hand-stitched tucks, and the double-breasted waistcoat held in a thick belly. Lottie thought he was about 6'2", mid-50s, straight russet hair, neatly coiffured. Teeth so white, they had to be veneers. A blue shirt and dark grey tie completed his executive look. She wanted to believe he wasn't handsome, but he was. His craggy jaw and bright eyes reminded her of Robert Redford.
I'm extremely busy.
He leaned forward, two hands placed firmly on the desk. What can I do for you? Mr. Ricard, Lottie spoke slowly, unconcerned for his busy schedule. She would take her time. You are aware of the suspicious death in the cathedral yesterday?
I saw the news report last night. Very tragic.
He sat back in his chair, creating space between them.
What's it got to do with me?
Can you account for your whereabouts from about 11 in the morning until 8 last night? She eyed Ricard. His expression was chameleon-like, fading from smug and pompous to inquiring and puzzled.
Why do I have to? I didn't know the victim.
Are you sure?
Can't be 100%. I meet many people in the course of my business. I don't remember everyone.
I'll ask you again. Can you account for your whereabouts yesterday, in particular between 11 a.m. and 8 p.m? She was beginning to enjoy this encounter. Maybe she was grasping at straws in the wind, but his altering body language told her to go for it.
I'll have to check my diary, he said reluctantly.
I'm talking about yesterday, not last year.
Surely you know where you were, what you did, and who you did it with. I travel all over the country, all over the world. I could have been on Wall Street, New York, yesterday.
Playing for time or concocting a web to spin a story?
Lottie didn't doubt that Tom Ricard wouldn't look a bit out of place on Wall Street. Stop wasting my time and yours, she said. Dublin Airport was closed from early morning yesterday because of the snow, so spin another one.
Opening up his iPad, he pounded an icon for his diary and index fingered the date. She peered across the desk trying to see the upside-down words. They raised their heads simultaneously, two sets of eyes challenging each other.
I was out and about. I had my PA cancel a meeting in Dublin because of the bad weather. So I did a few site visits.
She detected a hint of insolence returning to his voice. Can anyone vouch for you?
Vouch? He laughed.
What's funny?
Nothing, Inspector. Am I a suspect?
I'm trying to establish if you have a credible alibi.
There was no one on any of the sites. The weather, you know. Vouch? He repeated. I doubt it.
I need a list of those sites. He shrugged his shoulders. Anything else?
You got a phone call late afternoon, Lottie said, changing the emphasis of the conversation.
Ricard shifted in his seat.
What phone call?
The call James Brown made to you not long before he died.
He's dead?
Ricard said, his eyes widening. He appeared to gather his thoughts.
I don't know any James Brown, and I certainly didn't get any call from him.
Nice try. Lottie pulled a sheet of crumpled paper from her pocket. She unfolded it on the desk, ironing out the creases with her finger, taking her time. She picked up his silver pen and underlined the penultimate line of digits. The rest of the page was blacked out. Turning it towards him, she asked, Is that your number?
Looks like it.
It is your number. You know it's your number. What was James Brown ringing you about, shortly before he apparently wrapped a rope around his neck and hung himself?
Ricard didn't flinch. I won't deny I might have had dealings with Brown in the past. I'm sorry he's dead, but you're not going to pin this one on me, Inspector.
I'm not trying to pin anything on anyone. I asked a simple question.
He could have called me by mistake. I don't know.
He shrugged. The call lasted 37 seconds.
So?
I'll get a warrant for your phone records.
Do that. We're done here. I've important work to do.
Lottie watched as Ricard began opening and shutting drawers beneath his desk, dismissing her with his actions. She stood up,
I'll be back, Mr. Rickard.
I've no doubt about it, he said. No doubt in the world.
Happy New Year,
Lottie said, and walked out the door before he could reply. As she stepped into the lift, she knew she was on a collision course with Tom Rickard. That was probably not a good thing. Tom Rickard glared at the closed door in the ensuing silence. He pulled over the piece of paper with Brown's blanked-out phone calls from the last day of his life. He stared at his own number, crudely underlined. It was there in black and white, date, time, and call duration. He snorted and crumpled the page into his bin. He had too much to lose. Let them prove he spoke with Brown. Tom Rickard would deny, deny, deny. He tapped a speed dial number on his phone.
We need another meeting.
Chapter 16. Brown could have been susceptible to blackmail, judging by the paraphernalia in his bedroom, Boyd said to Lottie when she returned to the office. She stood, too wound up to sit still.
Having pictures of naked men on his bedroom wall? Come on, Boyd. That's nothing to be blackmailed over.
She paced up and down the small office. Corrigan's habit was catching. She'd sent Brown's laptop to the technical guys to trawl through and assigned a detective to check out the reported planning threats. She still had to interview Derek Hart, who had found James Brown's body. She wondered who he was and what he'd been doing at Brown's house. She instructed Lynch to find him after he'd failed to appear for the 10 a.m. appointment.
Someone, anyone, organise a Section 10 warrant for Tom Rickard's phone records, Lottie said. And check when the next district court is on. We need to get things moving.
Sit down, you're making me nervous, Boyd said. She sat. The desk phone rang.
Good afternoon, Detective Inspector, said the state pathologist. Are you available to come over to Tullamore? I know the weather is atrocious, but there are some things I think you should see.
Sure.
I've the preliminary reports ready.
Can you email them?
There's something I want to show you.
I'll be there in half an hour.
Any news? Boyd asked.
Get a life, Lottie said.
He'd heard every word of the conversation. Wish I had my own office back. She pulled on her jacket.
You might as well dream here as in bed, he said.
Jesus, he sounded more like her mother with every passing day. Lottie zipped up quickly, almost snagging her throat.
Where are you off to?
She didn't answer him and banged the door behind her.
Women, he said.
I heard that,
she shouted back. A minute later she returned, having eyed the state of the road outside.
Boyd?
Yes, Inspector.
Will you drive me to Tullamore?
Chapter 17. He was heading back to his office when he saw the teenage boy heading into Danny's bar, and he had to follow. The dark interior helped him meld into the woodwork. He watched as the youngster stretched towards a girl, kissed her mouth, then removed his coat. The man ordered a pint of Guinness, sat at the bar and angled himself on the stool so that he could see the young couple. The teenage boy shrugged his coat over his arm and linked his other arm around the girl's narrow waist. But the man wasn't interested in the girl. He loosened his tie at the collar of his shirt and continued to stare.
Are you going to drink that or offer it up?
The barman grinned at him. The man scowled, lifted his pint, and sipped before returning his gaze to the boy's delicate features. He shoved his legs further beneath the bar, shielding the hardening muscle under the zipper of his trousers. He had plenty to be doing, but for now all he wanted to do was sit and watch and imagine what it would feel like to have that youthful flesh in his hands. Chapter 18. The state pathologist Jane Doerr greeted Lottie and Boyd. A pair of tiny spectacles were perched on her prim nose,
and her dark green eyes peered through the glass. A smart navy skirt suit clung to her tiny body, and a blue blouse peeked out at her throat. She wore very high-heeled shoes. Lottie felt underdressed in her warm jacket jeans and long-sleeved top with a thermal vest underneath. She spent the 40-kilometre drive to Tullamore in silence. Boyd sang, out of tune, to the music on the radio, and she'd found it irritating but said nothing. Sometimes that was the best way to handle his moods.
"Welcome to the Dead House,"
Jane Dore said, extending a petite hand to Lottie. Lottie returned the handshake. "Call me Lottie."
"The Dead House?" she inquired.
"A throwback to the olden times. Come."
Jane led the way along a narrow corridor. Lottie followed, hoping the intense disinfectant smell would help blank out the scent of death. She doubted it. Boyd slipped into step behind them. The pathologist pushed open a swing door and entered a room with white tiles stretching from floor to ceiling. Three stainless steel tables stood in the centre. Two held bodies under stark white cotton sheeting. Susan Sullivan and James Brown, Lottie presumed. She could see reflections in the steel cabinets and recoiled from her own distorted image. Jane Dore sat on the high stool in the corner and booted up a computer.
"This takes ages to come alive," she said.
"Once that's all that comes alive," Lottie said, attempting to lighten the atmosphere. Boyd raised an eyebrow, folded his arm, said nothing. The pathologist drummed a red varnished fingernail on the bench. Lottie pulled over another stool and sat in silence, waiting for the computer to zip into cyberworld. "Did anything unexpected crop up?" she asked as Jane keyed in her password. No post-it stuck underneath the keyboard for this woman.
"Death in both cases was asphyxiation due to strangulation," she replied. "There is little evidence of defensive wounds on Sullivan's body. There's grazing on Brown's fingers and bruising on his neck around the ligature as if he tried to dislodge the rope. I also found some blue nylon fibre under his fingernails. I've sent all the fibre and hair to the forensic labs, and they have the rope too. There's a slight contusion at the base of his skull. I don't know what caused it, and until I have the forensic results, I cannot conclusively determine that his death was self-inflicted."
Lottie congratulated her gut instinct. She might still be proven wrong, but she was almost sure Brown hadn't committed suicide. A bump on the back of his head told her someone else was around last night.
"Sullivan was in a bad way."
The pathologist paused mid-sentence, pushing her spectacles back up her nose.
"And she may have given birth. I'm not 100% sure until I run more tests on the tissue I've extracted."
"Why can't she be sure?" Lottie asked.
"Her reproductive system is a mess. She was in the advanced stages of ovarian cancer. Both ovaries have tumours as large as mandarins, and there's another in her uterus."
"It had crossed my mind she might have had cancer," Lottie said, recalling the OxyContin in the victim's medicine cabinet.
"It's possible she confused the symptoms with menopause," Jane said.
"She knew," Lottie said with conviction.
"Ovarian cancer is silent. It's usually at an advanced stage when symptoms appear. Sullivan only had weeks to live, but someone got to her first."
Lottie thought back to the day Adam received his diagnosis. Had Susan gone through the same earth-shattering scenario with her doctor? How did she react? Did she take the news in a calm, dignified manner, like Adam? Or had she screamed at the doctor as she, Lottie, had?
"Are you all right?"
Jane Dore raised her eyebrows, concern knitted between them. "I'm fine, just thinking of something else." Lottie quickly composed herself, professionalism overriding her personal emotion. She felt like pounding her finger on the computer it was taking so long. But her nails were bitten and uneven. Better not, she thought.
"At last,"
the pathologist said, as a program pinged into life and a green U lit up the screen. She keyed in Susan Sullivan's name. Numerous lines of text and several icons appeared. She clicked, and an image of Sullivan's body filled the screen.
Here. You can see the ligature mark, a deep groove on the tissue. It's from a very thin plastic type wire. This is consistent with the iPod headphones found around the victim's neck. The lab is currently running analysis to confirm it as the murder weapon. A quick jerk, tightening for 15 to 20 seconds and the victim is dead.
Would the killer have to be a man?
Not necessarily. Using the right amount of force in the correct area, it could be either sex. There's limited bruising on the neck, so she didn't put up much of a fight.
Lottie watched as the pathologist moved the cursor further down the image and hovered over the victim's upper thigh.
What's that?
Lottie asked, squinting at the screen.
I believe it's a homemade tattoo. Indian ink, pounded onto the skin and jabbed repeatedly with a needle. It looks like lines in a circle. Not very clear. It's badly drawn and deep too. Incised with a knife, perhaps, then daubed with ink. I'll show you, she said. Put these on.
She extracted latex gloves from a drawer at her knee and handed them to Lottie and Boyd. Jumping down off her perch, she walked with small elegant steps to the nearest table and pulled back the sheet exposing the naked body of Susan Sullivan. A rough Y incision marked the woman's chest, crudely stitched with thick thread. Lottie shuddered. Is that what they had done to her, Adam? Dying at home had necessitated the undertaker placing his body in a steel box and bringing Adam to the hospital for a post-mortem. She had been too distraught at the time to object. Now, she didn't want to go there, so she forced her concentration to what the pathologist was indicating. Jane Dore moved one of the victim's legs and fingered the dead woman's inside thigh.
See?
She pointed to the mark on the victim's inner thigh. Lottie shifted her weight from one foot to the other, trying to shed her unease. She bent over to look. The dead woman's pubis was almost in her face. Yes, I see it, she murmured. Boyd remained in her shadow.
Now look at this.
At the second table, Jane whipped the sheet from the body. James Brown lay there, whiter than he had ever been in life, stitches traversing his chest also. The pathologist pulled his legs apart. Lottie stared at the mark comparable to the tattoo on Sullivan's inner thigh. Both were in similar locations. But this one was more oval-shaped, as if the hand of whoever had drawn it had slipped.
I've sent samples of the ink to the lab for analysis. Don't hold your breath waiting for a result.
I'm sure it isn't a county council initiation, right? Boyd said.
Nothing would surprise me nowadays, Lottie said.
In my opinion, these marks were made 30, 40 years ago. The growth of the epidermis and the fading ink would testify to that.
Lottie opened her mouth to say something, but decided against it. It was an important link between Susan Sullivan and James Brown, besides their work. Jane Dore printed off the tattoo images.
Happy hunting, she said, handing them to Boyd.
Blowing air through her nostrils, Lottie expelled the scent of decaying flesh. She peeled off the gloves, dropping them in a sterile bin beneath a bench. The pathologist scrolled down the computer screen and printed off her preliminary reports. Once she'd finished, she gave them to Lottie and returned to the bodies to tag and bag and do whatever it was a pathologist had to do to finish autopsies. Lottie didn't want to know about that. She leafed through the pages as she strolled behind Boyd and couldn't help wondering if Susan Sullivan had a child out there somewhere. Find out the name of Sullivan's doctor, she told Boyd. Hearing the click of high heels, she turned round to find Jane Dore standing behind her. Too close. Lottie's spine tingled. She was more uncomfortable with the living than the dead.
Get a grip, Parker. I'm going to get a bite to eat. Would you like to join me?
I'm sorry, said Lottie. DC Boyd and I have to get back to Ragmullen. Next time?
I hope we don't have a next time, if you follow me.
Lottie smiled. It was the other woman's only attempt at any kind of humour.
Chapter 19.
The light was on, making it awkward to differentiate between day and night. Lottie assumed it was early afternoon, judging by her rumbling stomach. They'd wasted no time getting back from Tullamore. She'd seen enough of the deadhouse. Derek Hart sat in the windowless, airless interview room. He had been at James Brown's house the night Brown died. He had called the emergency services and waited. Late 30s, straight brown hair cut tight above his ears and clean-shaven. His green eyes, submerged burnt-out embers, were lifeless in an ashen face. A masculine scent wafted from him, and Lottie wondered if he were trying to shield his look of femininity with cologne. He wore the fragrance like it was meant for someone else. Beneath his black padded North Face jacket, the hood of a red sweatshirt nestled around his broad neck. Cameras and microphones embedded in the walls. DVD recorder on. Formalities over. Hart began. James and I met last June. He closed his eyes at the memory, and a whisper of a smile creased his thin lips. Lottie empathized with him. Fleeting memories, causing secret smiles and unbidden tears, could erupt at the most inopportune moments. She knew it too well.
"Where did you meet him?"
she asked. "This is very delicate." He raised his eyes to meet hers. "Anything you say will be treated with utmost confidence," she said, not quite believing her own words.
"I met him through the internet. I'd been on this dating site for a while and never had the courage to engage with anyone. Until I came across James. He seemed nice, non-threatening, if you know what I mean."
Lottie nodded, not wanting to stop his flow of speech. Years of interviewing had honed her technique.
"He looked normal. No airs or graces about him.
I could tell that from his photograph and bio. I decided to email him and hit send before I could change my mind. He emailed me back, wanted to meet up. I couldn't believe he was interested in me." Hart looked at Lottie and continued. "I work in a school 60 kilometres from here."
"Where?"
"In Athlone."
"You met there?"
"No. I felt we needed to be discreet, so we met in a hotel in Tullamore."
"What did you talk about?"
"Our jobs, mainly. How stressful they were, how we coped. We didn't approach the subject of our sexuality. Not the first few times. I suppose you could call them dates, but we were just like two friends having a drink at the bar watching football. But we never watched the football."
"How did the relationship develop?"
Lottie asked, when it appeared he was not continuing.
"James invited me to his cottage. We had the most beautiful evening. He decorated the dining table with red roses and candles. I'd never experienced anything like it before. His attention to detail was exceptional. Things progressed from there."
"Progressed how?" Lottie asked, keeping him talking. "We became lovers. We had a future ahead of us." Hart paused, eyes closed, then continued with an air of authority. "James was the quietest, most inoffensive person you could meet. I can't understand why someone would do this to him. They destroyed his future, our future."
"Mr. Hart, at the moment we are still treating his death as a suicide. James had no reason to kill himself."
"Tell me about the pictures in his bedroom," Lottie said.
"Just posters," he shrugged.
"Heterosexual men put up calendars of women with their tits hanging out." He blushed.
"Sorry, but it's true."
"James liked his posters. There's no law against it, is there?"
"Not that I know of."
"We were just two men in a relationship." His shoulders slumped.
"Did you notice a tattoo on James' thigh?"
"Yes," he said.
"Did you ask him about it?"
"He was very defensive. Told me it was none of my business. From a previous lifetime."
"That's what he said.
A previous lifetime.
That's all? Lottie asked. This memory, whatever it was, seemed to cause him pain, so I never mentioned it again. Hart closed his eyes, breathing deeply. Are you all right? Would you like a drink, water, coffee?
I'm fine.
Were you with James for Christmas?
Lottie moved the interview forward.
Yes. He drove through the snow on Christmas Eve to visit me. He was agitated, though. Annoyed that he couldn't get back for some appointment that evening, but the weather was so bad he had to stay with me.
What appointment could he have had on Christmas Eve?
I've no idea. But we got to spend Christmas Day together, Hart smiled. It's the happiest I've ever been since I stopped believing in Santa Claus.
When did you last see him?
Since Stephen's Day. He went home that day. He was returning to work on December 27th.
Do you have a key to his cottage?
No. There's a place where he leaves it, though.
Where might that be?
Under a stone, at the apple tree in the courtyard.
Lottie sighed. Was everyone just like her in relation to home security?
Could anyone else be aware of this?
I've no idea.
Was it James's key in the door last night?
I presume so. I didn't go near it, he said.
After a moment, he continued, his voice broken. The minute I parked behind his car, I saw him, hanging there.
Did you see anyone else around? Other cars? Anyone pass you on the avenue or the main road?
Nothing. I saw nothing, Inspector.
Just James.
Hanging there.
Like...
He covered his mouth with his hands, resting his elbows on the table, swallowing a sob. Lottie wrote in her notebook, even though their conversation was being recorded. She needed to gather her thoughts.
Do you know if he owned a small green flashlight?
Hart shook his head.
I don't know.
Why were you at the house last night?
We'd arranged to meet tonight, for New Year's Eve. But then he phoned me about Susan Sullivan's death. He sounded so upset.
So you decided to drive through a snowstorm?
Yes, Inspector, I did.
Lottie watched him. He appeared sincere.
Had his mood changed in recent times? She asked.
Hart thought for a moment.
James told me a few months ago that Susan was diagnosed with cancer. He seemed to have known her a long time, but I never met her. Once I asked if he'd introduce us. He didn't.
Did he tell you anything else about Susan?
Only that she'd been through a lot in her life.
He spoke as if he shared her troubles.
James was like that. A sympathetic soul.
Now that I think of it, he seemed obsessed with her at times.
Any idea why?
I imagine it was something to do with their work.
What could that be?
He was incensed by a vote on a council development plan. Kept saying he couldn't believe they'd rezoned something or other. I don't understand all that, but I'm sure it'll be easy for you to find out. It's just a matter of knowing what to look for.
And therein lies the crux of the matter, Lottie said, thinking of Kirby's bulging face having to trawl through a morass of planning files.
Do you have any idea when this was?
Not sure. Possibly June or July?
I honestly don't know. It could be nothing, Inspector.
Leave that for me to determine, she said. They had nothing already. What harm would another bit of nothing do?
I have so many regrets.
I know the feeling, Lottie said. She thought of all she'd buried along with Adam, feelings she couldn't cope with.
Thank you, Mr. Hart. You can go, she said, folding over her notebook. But I'll need to speak to you again.
Any time, Hart said. He got up and walked out the door, wearing his jacket like a dead weight on his shoulders. When he was gone, his scent remained, wrestling the air around Lottie. A bitter smell of deep loss. She recognized it, and hoped Hart could mourn, putting his grief behind him. She doubted it. And for some reason, despite all that, Lottie had a nagging doubt at his sincerity.